Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome to JS on Politics, our weekly look at what's happening in Wisconsin politics. I'm your host, Greg Borowski, and we have a full show today. I'll give you a quick rundown of what to expect. The Republican presidential contenders are headed to Milwaukee next week. We'll preview the debate, and we'll look at how the top-tier hopefuls have fared on the Truthometer in recent days. The city budget is headed to the mayor. We'll get an update on how it was changed by the Common Council and how that will impact the spring election. Finally, we'll take a look at what's happening in Madison this week, what bills are ready to move as the fall session winds down. And of course, we'll take some viewer questions. But we'll start at the top with our, our federal segment today as we hit all branches or levels of government. And we have Craig Gilbert, our Washington Bureau Chief, joining us from Washington, D.C. Craig, what's your sense? It's a week since the last debate. The opinions have settled in a little bit. You know, who's got the most to gain and most to lose as Tuesday comes up for the Milwaukee debate?
Well, you know, we're going to find out tonight who's on the main stage. So there's one cutoff. Chris Christie could be a casualty this time around. If he doesn't meet a polling threshold, he's not even going to be on the main stage. So he would be someone who's got a lot to lose. I think Jeb Bush has a lot to gain and a lot to lose because he hasn't been performing well in the debates. And he's kind of at a critical moment in the campaign where he doesn't want to go down the Scott Walker road of being a candidate who came into the process with a lot of stature, only to saw it diminish. So there's a lot on the line for Jeb Bush. You know, somebody who's not going to be on the stage who has something at stake in this debate is Rice Rebus, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, because the RNC took a lot of fire over the last debate, and they're hoping to have a better debate from their point of view this time around with Fox Business than they had with CNBC.
All right, well, let's bring in our panelists on here with me in the studio, Mary Spicuzza and Dan Bice. Who do you guys think? Who would you put as the biggest person in terms of at most at stake on Tuesday?
Well, I think, as Craig said, the focus will be on Jeb Bush. I mean, he's not had a good performance yet in the first three debates, and he continues to reboot. And I don't know how many times you can reboot your
turning
campaign.
The computer on and off. Eventually, you hope it's going to.
And you know, he's not had a good debate at all. I mean, so I think the focus is going to be on him. And you know, two of the candidates surged as a result of the last debate, and that's Cruz and Rubio. Both of whom did well. The two leaders, Trump and Carson, seem immune to any sort of effect from
What do you think, Mary? Jeb Bush is not, he's not a particularly good debater, it turns out, at least it's evidence so far.
Yeah, no, I mean, he dropped in speaking time last time. He's like moving further down the stage from the center. And I think there is a real concern that he's going to have the Scott Walker effect of going from hero to zero or front runner to like kind of also ran. So I think he's got a lot at stake. And Rubio, I think, too, because he did do so well. Expectations are high, and now he's kind of emerging, and I think there's going to be a lot of fire directed at him, and Trump already has been criticizing him, and he's going to have to answer questions.
And there were a number of stories raised about his spending in the past, even going back 10 years or whatever. But it's funny because the debate doesn't have the same impact on everybody. I thought Chris Christie had a pretty decent debate last time, but he's still at 2% in most polls. So even though he did fairly well, and I thought Trump didn't have a particularly good debate last time, and still he's running 1 or 2 in most polls.
Yep. And Carson, I didn't think he had a particularly good debate, and he's like surpassing Trump in some polls.
Let me ask Craig, from your perspective, we've seen before, and we sort of really saw it with Scott Walker a little bit, of how the expectation gets in there of, you know, that this is a make or break debate for Scott Walker, and then it's evaluated in that context. Is that what Jeb Bush is facing this time?
He could be. I mean, Scott Walker was a classic case of, you know, he had a debate that was seen retrospectively as a bad debate, debate number one. And by the time the second debate rolled around, he was in a complete no-win situation because the panel was ignoring him because they didn't think he was a player anymore. And everybody was saying he needed to hit a home run to have a successful debate. And those two things didn't add up for him. I think we're getting to that point with Jeb Bush. He's not a good debater. He's not good on television. So it's a lot to ask of him and his campaign to look to a debate and that kind of format to rescue him.
I think the person for me that I'm going to be watching is Ted Cruz, because he seems to be getting better with each performance.
Yeah, kind of, and his numbers,
I mean,
up,
if you're looking in terms of the direction, his poll numbers are getting better and better at around 10-11% now, start off at 2 or 3%. I just want to see if that momentum continues for him through this debate.
And he has some money going for him, too. Not like Jeb Bush money, but he has a pretty solid war chest.
Yeah. So, Craig, let me ask you another question here. So there was that candidate kind of revolt against Reince Priebus and the RNC, but also against CNBC. What do we think we'll see any change in format in this one, or change in the type of questions that are coming at him?
The Fox Business Channel network is doing a few things differently, not in response to the candidates, because that whole dialogue is sort of taking place outside of this upcoming debate, but they are giving the candidates more time to respond to questions and more time for rebuttal. And I talked to Neil Cavuto, one of the moderators, yesterday about the kind of debate they're hoping to have. They want it to be, you know, substantive. They want it to cover this kind of ground of the economy, business, finance, government, size of government, spending, taxes, that you would expect from a business channel. This is a big deal for them because they're a cable network that normally doesn't get 10 million viewers like they could get or more in this debate. So they have a lot at stake too, but they're promising and vowing to have a debate that's tough and pointed but respectful.
And this debate's going to come against a backdrop of a lot of things going on in Milwaukee and Wisconsin. This has not been a particularly good week for Scott Walker and for the Wisconsin economy, with Oscar Mayer moving out, S.C. Johnson saying it's moving jobs to Chicago, and the talk that Foley and Lardner might be bought by a British firm. And this is a state with a number of Republican policies that have been put into place. It'll be interesting to see if there's any discussion about that.
Yeah, let me just ask finally to Mary and Dan here on the, and ordinarily this would be kind of a coup for Scott Walker to have this debate in your home state. Maybe not so excited about it this time, but does he keep a low profile during this? Do you think we'll see him, you know?
Well, he's doing an event beforehand. Yeah. He's doing an event that morning where he'll be talking about the current state of the presidential race, his political future. I'm sure he'll be saying, you know, more people should follow my lead. I was smart to get out when I did.
What I'm interested in is to see if this is what the Wall Street Journal, to see if they can get anything out of him that we haven't been able to get out of him, because he's refused to talk about what happened with his campaign from the first debate on. He's just continued to say, you know, I've said all I'm going to say about it. He's going to be on air for an hour taking questions from them. He can't for an hour say, I'm not going to answer that question.
September 21st.
September 21st is what I said about it. Right. That was the last I was going to say.
And it was like 3 minutes, 4 minutes with no questions.
Right. So. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll leave that discussion there, and we're going to go now to a tape segment looking at how the top-tier GOP contenders have fared on the Truthometer. We're joined now by Tom Kircher, one of our PolitiFact Wisconsin reporters, to give us a preview of what the candidates and how they fared on the Truthometer in anticipation of Tuesday's debate. So, Tom, these are ratings from PolitiFact National, and we grabbed the most recent one from the top five candidates in the polls. So let's start with the first one, which is from Ben Carson, who says his tax plan wouldn't leave the federal government with a $1.1 trillion hole, and we rated that false.
Carson's tax proposal features a 15% flat tax. The experts found that it would leave a $1.1 trillion hole in terms of revenue versus taxes collected. And actually, Carson himself, his own numbers indicated a $1 trillion hole as well.
Okay, our next one was from Donald Trump, who says the CNBC debate, that was the last one, was supposed to be 3 hours, but he renegotiated it down to 2 hours, and we rated that mostly false.
Mostly false because Trump had a role, among other people, in negotiating the time change, but he was only one. And secondly, the original plan for the debate was 2 hours, 15 minutes, not 3 hours.
Okay. All right, Marco Rubio, his claim was there was never a single shred of evidence presented to anyone that the attacks in Benghazi, Libya were spontaneous, and in fact the CIA themselves understood that early on, and that rating was half true.
You know, and he says there was no single shred of evidence, that goes too far. Early on there were some indications that maybe the attack was a result of a protest or a video, At the same time, there was quite a bit of evidence early on that it was strictly a terror attack.
All right. And Ted Cruz, the Texas senator, says, my campaign finished the last quarter reporting the most cash on hand of any Republican in the field, $13.8 million in the bank, and $3.5 million more than the Jeb Bush campaign. And that was rated mostly true.
Mostly true because he was correct on the numbers, strictly speaking, in terms of how much money is in his campaign fund versus Bush's. But it didn't take into account some PAC money, which won't be reported for a while, and that might actually show that Bush is ahead.
All right, and our last one, this is from Jeb Bush. He says, if you look at the three people on the debate stage from the U.S. Senate, so that'd be Rubio, Cruz, and Rand Paul,
right. All
three of them have a combined two bills that became law that they've sponsored, and that was rated mostly true.
Again, mostly true because that's correct on the numbers. But among the three of them, only two of the bills they sponsored have become law. But we pointed out that experts say that's not a terrific way to measure the effectiveness of a legislature. They certainly do many other things as well.
All right. Well, we'll be watching the debate on Tuesday for more Truth and Meter items and facts to check. In the meantime, you can check these and more at politifact.com. And if you have suggestions after the debate for us for facts to check, send it to politifact@journalsentinel.com. Thanks, Tom.
You bet.
All right, we're back live again with Mary Spicuzzi, who's been covering City Hall, and Dan Bice, of course. And let's talk a little bit about the city budget. So the Common Council passed it the other day.
Mm-hmm.
This is always a document that affects a lot of our viewers and listeners. But in the spring, it helps set up Mayor Barrett for the spring election. So what did the council do to the mayor's budget?
So I would say a lot of the amendments were friendly amendments. They were adding, he had already proposed 100 additional officers to essentially cover attrition. They added 20 and worked with his office on that. They added some job and workforce development programs that he also supported, added a heroin and opiate position that would be like a civilian working with the police department. So I would not say this was like a major rewriting of the budget. A lot of this was probably more tinkering around the edges.
Right. And where did it wind up with sort of the bottom line for taxpayers in terms of the rate or the levy and what they'll expect?
It's pretty much holding, the levy is pretty much, they essentially even, and then a slight reduction in the tax rate, so pretty much holding the line on taxes. And the body cameras are left in. Yeah. They'll be a little later than originally proposed, but they'll be, I think it's $1,200 if I'm remembering correctly.
All right, so it's an interesting situation because you have Alderman Donovan and Alderman Davis who are, of course, running against the mayor. Did they do anything in the budget to try to get their own, points of view and their own amendments in there, or did they just let it pass?
They did. No, Alderman Donovan tried to get 50 additional officers and held a press conference. He put out a news release about it. He had Mike Crivello from the police union with him at that news release. He reintroduced it on the floor after it failed in committee, failed again on the floor. Basically, he was trying to eliminate higher-level positions and saying it would be funded through that, but it didn't.
And this is the first time he's done this.
Yeah, almost kind of an annual.
Yeah, this is an annual thing, a right that he does some sort of campaign stunt to say he wants to increase the number of officers there, and it doesn't pass.
Well, we're just, not many months away from the election here in April, and the primary before that. So
right.
Have either of these guys gotten any traction among voters in terms of Donovan and Davis?
I think they're both going to criticize the mayor on public safety. There's been a spike in homicides. We're at like a 10-year high. I think he's going to have questions about public safety. I don't know that either of them have. We've seen this in a lot of cities around the country, though, so I don't know that either of them have like a magic solution to that, but I think we're going to hear a lot about it on the campaign trail.
There's had been some talk that Lena Taylor might run, but I hear she's not going to now. So, as you said, the primary is in February. We're just a few months away, and neither of them has put forth much of a vision that's an alternative
if you assume that, and it's probably a safe assumption that Tom Barrett will make it through the primary, who of those other two is more likely to make it through, or who would be his tougher opponent?
I think that the factor that is unknown right now is whether some outside group comes in and decides to take shots at Tom Barrett and tries to soften him up. But I think Alderman Davis hasn't really made much headway at all. I would guess that it would be Alderman Donovan. He's at least out there talking about crime and punishment issues. And trying to promote himself as the law and order candidate. I don't actually know what Joe Davis's, what his theme is. If you're to say, what he's hoping to accomplish, I don't know what that is.
So if you're Tom
Barrett,
who would you prefer to run against?
I think he'd probably rather run against Donovan. I could be wrong. I mean, Donovan does have a high profile because he's been hitting the mayor for longer, but at the same time, there are some probably weaknesses that they're thinking they could exploit. But, you know, who knows if the Koch brothers decide. They've been saying that they were going to spend money, or Americans for Prosperity, in local races. So
or
who knows?
Or Choice Group, which has been active here before and has gotten involved in a number of Milwaukee races. I mean, they could come in with just some negative ads against Mayor Barrett. But right now, there isn't an alternative vision. I always think the budget is set up so that September, October, if you really want to present yourself as a candidate who's an alternative to the mayor, you should come in, lay out a plan, and all we got was 50 more police officers. That's not much of a broad vision for the city.
Well, let's talk briefly about the county budget. And there was, you know, Dan, you wanted to talk a little bit about the
sure.
back and forth with the board and Sheriff with Clark and Disabley.
The board decided to add $4 million to Sheriff Clark's budget. And it came at a time when Sheriff Clark was saying a lot of vitriolic stuff, saying that Black Lives Matter movement's going to join with ISIS to overthrow the government. And also, I wrote a story this week about how he tried to serve service process server and have a face-to-face encounter with Chris Abley. And so Chris Abley has taken this and these statements to ask the county board to rescind that $4 million that they've added to the budget. And some of the county board members have said what the sheriff is saying is distasteful, but they're planning to keep that $4 million in there. And so, I mean, it's an interesting thing. The county board is stuck between Chris Abley, whom they hate, and Sheriff Clark, who says stuff that they can't support. So where do they go on this? And right now, they're leaning in favor of Sheriff Clark, but that's sort of a no-win situation.
The money's probably helping.
Where do they go in the spring? Do you think some of the board members will support Chris Larson, who is a former board member?
Sure. But Theo Lipscomb used to be his campaign treasurer, so I think he's going to. And you, this week, Chris Abley went to there with some of his first advertisements, and I saw the transit union decided this week to endorse Chris Larson. So things are already moving, and it's going to be a much more interesting race than what's happening at City Hall.
All right. Well, we'll leave that discussion there and go right now to a tape segment looking at the close of the fall legislative session in Madison.
All right. We're going to turn now to Madison, where we have our one of our Madison reporters, Patrick Marley, on the line to talk about the end of the legislative session for this year anyways. So, Patrick, there's the Senate's in session tomorrow to tidy up a few things. Let's start with the campaign finance reforms. What's been the holdup there, and what changes are we expecting tomorrow?
Well, this bill's sort of been in the works for years. Republicans have long wanted to make changes to the campaign finance laws to update it. It hasn't been updated since the 1970s. There have been a lot of court decisions from Citizens United by the U.S. Supreme Court down to a recent decision this summer from the state Supreme Court that changed campaign finance laws. They want to match those up. They're also doing some things that are go beyond what the courts have said they need to do. One of the things in there is doubling campaign finance limits. The Assembly passed this recently. The Senate, both are controlled by Republicans, had some concerns about it. They've now overcome those and are going to the floor on Friday. The overall bill itself is pretty similar. There are some changes, such as the Assembly had taken out the requirement that donors have to disclose who they work for. The Senate is putting that back in, so anybody who makes a donation of more than $200 has to list their employer.
All right, yeah, that sounds like a picayune issue maybe to voters, but it really helps people understand what if particular companies and industries are all getting behind a particular candidate, right?
Right. I mean, for instance, in 2009, you could do an analysis of payday lenders and see that they'd pumped $75,000 into the campaign accounts of Democrats and between the Republicans and Democrats had put $75,000 in as they tried to limit regulations that were put on their industry. Also, you had the case of Bill Gardner from Wisconsin Southern Railroad. He had been giving either company money or his own money to employees to give to candidates as a way to get around campaign finance limits. That was information that was easier to figure out because of the employer.
All right, and there's two other issues I want to touch on. One that's coming up again tomorrow is the Government Accountability Board changes. Is that pretty well set to move in the format it's been in, or do you expect any changes there?
We'll see one or two significant changes to that. This is, again, the accountability board runs elections and oversees ethics laws. Republicans think that it's unfair to them, and so they're splitting it into two bipartisan commissions, three members from the Democrats, three members from the Republicans. The existing accountability board is made up of six former judges. Some Republicans in the Senate like that model. They wanted to see some role for judges on the new ethics commission, and so it's going to include two former judges among the six members.
All right. And lastly, there was action yesterday at the Joint Finance Committee on borrowing for roads. And this is a case where Governor Walker got his way, right, where there's more borrowing going to be allowed to get more projects back on track.
Right. The governor had wanted $1.3 billion to be borrowed for roads over 2 years. The Republicans in the legislature said that that was way too much. They cut that back to $500 million, but left this avenue for getting an additional $350 million over 2 years. Republicans were split on that issue on the Joint Finance Committee yesterday, with half of them saying they could get the money, half of them saying they couldn't. Democrats came to the side of allowing the bonds to be issued. And so over the next 2 years, that'll mean we borrow $850 million instead of $500 million. That will limit delays on road projects, but there were five major projects that were going to be delayed for 2 years. They will now be delayed for 1 year. So even with the extra money, we're still going to see some slowdown on some road work.
All right. Well, that's where we'll leave our Madison update for today. Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks, Greg.
All right. We're back with Dan and Mary. And give me your assessment of how this fall session went. I mean, it's basically over. There's these final things that they want to clean up, but what's the headline out of it? Is there a headline out of it?
This was not like, I would not say this was their most productive fall session. They did the GAB, they did the campaign finance stuff. A lot of stuff seems to be stalled or not necessarily passing. The Blaze Pink passed, but like there's bills to defund Planned Parenthood in a couple of different ways. There's fetal tissue bills. I would say that, you know, bills have not been flying to the governor's desk for his signature.
The interesting thing is we have all of these things going on in the economy, as I mentioned earlier, with Oscar Mayer moving and SC Johnson moving some of its jobs down. And all of these ideas seem pretty unrelated to what's going on in the economy, whether it's the Blaze Pink stuff or the Government Accountability Board. Or the campaign finance rules. And I understand they want to get those things in place for the election next year, and that makes more sense. But some of the other ones, the Planned Parenthood provisions that didn't get out of committee or get past get to the Senate, it just seems like a lot of activity, but not much was done.
Yeah, well, is this just the byproduct of the fact that Scott Walker was running for president much of this time, and it was up to lawmakers to sort of set their own agenda?
It's been that way for almost the entire year. I mean, he proposed a budget, and it was rewritten, and it was it took a long time to get that passed. But yeah, I mean, I think there's a vacuum of power right now, and you know, about the only thing he's contributed so far is to agree with proposals that are out there and say I like this or I don't like this, and to push this administrative rule that would require drug testing for people receiving public benefits. But he's been out there touring the state, but he hasn't really laid out an agenda for what he wants to do the rest of this term.
All right, well, let's turn to viewer questions now, because the first one is right on that theme. This is from James Dean, who, a little weird, and this is not John Dean, might be even more on point, I guess, but this is a few weeks ago you guys talked about what Scott Walker needs to do to make nice with state voters. Has he done it? Seems like he is still leading from behind.
Yeah, I think he's gonna have to get more flowers and chocolates out or something. I mean, he's kind of moving further from his 250,000 jobs pledge at this point with like 1,000 Oscar Mayer jobs. And I think he needs to be out and really looking like he is pushing to improve the economy. And with the GAB stuff and campaign finance stuff, it kind of seems like a side issue.
The thing that it appears from all the polling is that he's lost the middle. The people, the moderates, are not with him right now. And most of the proposals that he's put forward that he's agreed with are more conservative proposals. I'm interested in seeing what he's going to offer that will have broader support outside of just the Republican Party.
Yeah. Well, it'll be tough for him perhaps even next year, because you've got people will be consumed with the presidential race. He doesn't have a budget to propose. So here's my new agenda?
It's a tough thing to run for president and to drop out, throw everything you have into it, and you've got your whole family involved. And you know, I think it's not unreasonable to think that there's going to be some recovery time from that. But, you know, what he likes to do is to hit the road, meet voters, talk to them, and do those things. And he is going out and talking to people, but there'd been a lack of ideas so far since September 21st.
All right, our next question is from Wisconsin Home, who says, is Wisconsin still going to matter by the time the primary election rolls around? Donald Trump and Ben Carson will blow up before that time, right? I assume they mean blow up as in, like, explode,
tank.
Not blow up these days, as in, like...
Well, you know, right now, most polls are showing that 50% of the Republican voters are saying that that's either Carson or Trump's the first preference. But at the same time, one of the polls this week showed 63% of the people said that they are willing to change who they're supporting between now and the time that they get to vote. So things are very volatile. I think Wisconsin will still matter. I think it'll still matter on the Republican side, probably not so much on the Democratic side.
All right, let's take a question here from Rosie, who says, in his first ad, Chris Abley takes a lot of credit for things going right. Shouldn't he be giving Scott Walker all the credit? And I assume that means due to Act 10 and some of the things that that Abley's been able to do now, perhaps without, you know, board approval and things like that.
You know, Chris Abley did do some things on his own, particularly on fiscal issues, which he takes pride in terms of holding down spending. I, for one, thought he would be a tax and spend liberal, and he's certainly not been that. So, but the last person that I expect Chris Abley to praise in the middle of a campaign video is to say, thank you, Scott Walker, for all you did for us. Since, you know, he got into office by campaigning against Scott Walker back in 2011. That was his campaign theme. I am not Scott Walker, basically.
Maybe that'll be Chris Larson's ad attacking him, is that it really is.
It's really,
yeah, it's all Scott Walker,
that would
yes.
be a little twists and turns.
Another term of Scott Walker.
Yeah. Here's a question from Luke, who I'll kind of boil it down. He basically asks, you know, we're a year away from the 2016 election. Will Glenn Grothman, Reid Ribble, and Sean Duffy face any substantial competition, or will they sort of get free rides in the election next year?
The fact of the matter is the Democratic bench is very short, and I don't see any, you know, substantial, you know, competition. In fact, a couple of those candidates are looking ahead and talking about the potential of their running for governor. So I think they're not even focused on their 2016 elections. Right. But, yeah. You know, there's been some talk that Reid Ribble and Sean Duffy have some interest in, if Scott Walker doesn't run for a third term, that they might get into the race.
Yeah. Well, and the reality is, too, the redistricting makes those seats very hard for a Democrat to compete against, and there isn't
right.
necessarily a room on the right to come in and say these guys aren't conservative enough.
It would be interesting to see the person who runs to the right of Glenn Grothman. I mean, it's a really conservative district, so that's probably what it would take to beat him, and that's a hard thing to imagine.
And they've tried to knock off Duffy a couple of times now, and you're unsuccessful. You know, it's usually your first reelect that's the toughest one, and, you know, they've cleared that hurdle.
All right, finally, we have a question that came in on Twitter, and it was basically asking, how can Walker say that crushing unions is good for the economy? When Wisconsin's economy is struggling so bad, I mean, so I don't know if Walker was crushing unions directly, but I mean, the gist of it was.
I don't think he said, except when he was running for president.
Yeah.
but
I mean, there
he says that in like Nevada or South Carolina, but not here.
Yeah. I think Nikki Haley said we both are union crushers or something. You want to take that one, Danny Boy?
he's going to say that because that's his signature act. He's going to say Act 10 has been responsible, and he's going to blame Obama for whatever economic problems the state has. I mean, it's a pretty simple formula by now, so it's very easy for him to say that.
All right, well, let's leave that there for today. We're going to thank Dan and Mary for joining us, and I hope you tune in next week when we'll be able to do a recap of the GOP debate. And please stay tuned and join us next week.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.